Pierce Brown is being interviewed by Renee Garlick for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place at his home at 154 Balls Hill Road on December 17, 2003. Mr. Brown is 68 years old and a lifelong resident of Concord. Life today in Concord is certainly very different than when you were growing up and during your parents' time. When did your parents come to Concord?
My parents, Grace and Paige Brown, were married in 1929, and after an extended wedding trip to Europe, they arrived back in Boston on the steamer and came directly to Concord, Mass., where my father had rented a house known as Miss Pride's House, which is still on the top of Ripley Hill Road off of Monument Street in Concord. And this house had been built by Mr. Stedman Buttrick Sr. for the governess who had brought up his children, his wife having died in childbirth. And when she retired, Mr. Buttrick built this house for her. And on the brass knocker, I think still to this day, you'll see the words Pride, P-R-I-D-E. At any rate, my mother and father lived there for six happy years until I was born and there was no longer enough room for me and my older brother. So my father bought a brick house, which is still standing at 177 Barnes Hill Road. And this is where I grew up. At that time, 1936, that was the only house on Barnes Hill Road. To be sure, it's not the biggest street in the world, but it's probably a mile long. And today, I counted up that there are about 10 houses on that street. So quite a difference there. The real estate broker that found Miss Pride's house and also my parents' house on Barnes Hill Road for my dad was Beth Baldwin, Mrs. David Baldwin of Concord. And the real estate business in those days was run on a very informal basis compared to today. She operated out of her home, as indeed did her successors, who were Mrs. Horace Arnold, and then followed by Mrs. Winthrop Lee, Barbara Lee. They all operated out of their homes, too, right up into the, probably the 1970s. There were some other real estate brokers, like Fred T. Boyd, who had offices downtown. These were the prominent real estate people in Concord at the time. And Beth Baldwin, she showed my dad the Pride House and then later the house on Barnes Hill Road. Looking back to the neighborhood and what it was like in the late 1930s and the 1940s, which form my earliest recollections, the neighbors that we have had there obviously were quite a bit further away than neighbors are today. Some of those neighbors were Mr. and Mrs. Raymond Emerson, who lived at the end of Festival Road, on the site where the Rasmussen house now is, at the very end of the road. Mr. Emerson was a huge landowner in Concord. He might have been Concord's largest landowner at that time. Owned most of the Estabrook Woods, the largest part anyway, along with the Buttrick family and the Robb family at that time. As a small boy, Mr. Emerson, who was Ralph Waldo Emerson's grandson, not only from that perspective, but for many other reasons, was a totally fascinating person for a small boy in Concord being me at that time. he was a man of many parts. He loved horseback riding, and he kept a stable of three or four horses. He loved pistols, rifles, hunting, firearms, dynamite. He often removed stumps with sticks of dynamite, and this is why he only had eight fingers on his hand, which was very exciting to me. He also knew how to fly an airplane, and he made his fields available to the Concord Police Department for their target practice, and I often used to go up and use either his pistols or my pistols and shoot right alongside with members of the Concord Police Department in their pistol training. I often rode horseback before breakfast with Mr. Emerson. This is one of my keenest memories. He was a very aggressive rider. He used to like to tear along at a very brisk pace, usually a gallop. And he had a crop or a whip that he carried, which was a long stick with sort of cat and nine tails at the end of it, which he would use not on the horse but to knock overhanging branches in the trail and get them out of the way. So it was really quite a lusty experience to ride horseback through the Estabrook Woods with Mr. Emerson. At the end of those rides, we would come back and tie up our horses and go into his house, and his cook would serve us wonderful big breakfast, using pancakes and syrup and maybe some eggs and bacon on the side. Wonderful memories. He also was an avid hunter, and he used to go out west frequently, shoot mountain lions. And on one occasion, he killed the mother, and he found the cub, and he brought the mountain lion cub back. Kept it as a pet until it got too big, and then he had to turn it over to Benson's Wild Animal Farm up in Hudson, New Hampshire. Bert Newbery, who was a very good friend of Mr. Emerson's, referred to him as a good rough and ready surveyor. And he surveyed many parts of the neighborhood. I can remember him out on a winter's day with his tripod, the Alblight or Transit or whatever it might be, and his clipboard, usually with an assistant. Other neighbors, of course, down the street were Mr. and Mrs. Stedman Buttrick, whose father had built what is now called the Buttrick Mansion. And his son, who was closer to my age, Stedman Buttrick, who was the third Stedman Buttrick, who is living now in Concord, has been all his life. The Buttrick Farm, as we called it in those days, had one of New England's most outstanding gardens. It truly was a magnificent state, and they had at all times during the summer two or three full-time gardeners. Mr. Buttrick was the president of the American Iris Society, and every June when the iris were at their peak, he would have a picture, huge white tent, and there would be a gathering of members from far and wide for the American Iris Society. It truly was a grand showplace, and it was kept right up to the nines at all times. Another great garden in Concord was that of our neighbor, Mrs. Russell Robb, at Monument Street, and she had another beautiful, large, extensive hillside garden, which was maintained by professional gardeners under full-time payroll. She, incidentally, interestingly, was the daughter of Edward Sylvester Morse, who was the director of the Peabody Museum in Salem going back into the 19th century, and later the Boston Museum of Natural History. He's prominently featured in a new book called The Great Wave, which is the opening up of Japan. And he led a vanguard of other Bostonians in the 1870s and 1880s who were interested in Japanese culture, which was fast being disappeared. And they picked up many of the remnants of that culture, which was being discarded by the new young Turks who had taken over the government of Japan in order to drag it into the 20th century. So a very prominent, interesting family. I remember Mrs. Robb. Well, she was a very old lady when I first knew her, but she was somewhat remote, and she stayed close to home. Her husband had died in 1927, and her brother, John Morse, lived on Ripley Hill Road. She grew up Ripley Hill Road, the first house on the left, who I did know quite well, and his wife, Mrs. Morse, interestingly enough, which I just found out, was the daughter of John Philip Sousa, the famous band leader and composer.
I was told back then Mrs. Robb was very welcoming for people to come see her garden rather than keep out.
Absolutely. As you drive up Monument Street at the lower end of her property where the big wall starts, you can still see a little opening beautifully crafted in the stone wall, and that was where the public could come in. You'd enter at the bottom of the garden, at the bottom of the hill, and then you would go. She and her husband had built Concord's first swimming pool, which their children were privileged to have access to.
On her ground.
On her property, yes. The other swimming pool was over at Sudbury Road, what was then Wilson Place, which we also spent a lot of time in. I think those were the only two swimming pools in Concord back in the 40s and 50s.
So this was open to people that they knew in town?
Yes, this was by invitation, and we felt lucky. These people were friends of my parents. As long as we were on best behavior, we could go over without asking permission.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned cooks and gardeners. It seemed like a well-ordered society, you know, if you could afford the domestic help.
Yes, absolutely. The availability of domestic service, of course, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s was widespread. And this allowed, as you say, for those who could afford it, although it was very inexpensive looking back, allowed for a much different and, if you will, gracious lifestyle. Growing up, we always had a cook. Many years we had a cook and a butler. When my brother and I were small, there was a baby's nurse who lived in as well, and somebody outside a couple of days a week to look after the garden and the lawn, etc. So this gave the lady of the house a lot of leisure time. I'm always reminded of the fact that Anderson's Market, which is in the brick building down in the center of the Millville, they had a fleet of delivery trucks. And you used to get the list of food that was needed. Either the cook or my mother would call down to Anderson's, and they had a reception standing on the phone named Nellie, who's a great friend of ours. And she would write up the order, and a couple of hours later, one of the delivery trucks would zoom up and they'd deliver it right in and put it up on the kitchen table. So that made it a lot easier than going to the Stop and Shop or wherever. The Economy Grocery Stores was the other market in Concord Center, which I think was the predecessor of Stop and Shop. That was run by Frank, and the butcher was Mr. Vaughn. I also remember the butcher at Anderson's. His name was Jack, and historically butchers, I guess in England, always wore straw boaters, and certainly Jack was never without his. And he also had those green arm suspenders, I think they were called, that were made out of isinglass, and they would keep the cuffs up out of the way of the food. They wore these big sort of leather don't know what you'd call them, armlets or something to protect their upper arms from the chopper, I guess. I'm not sure.
The Economy was on Main Street?
The Economy was on Walden Street.
Oh, Walden Street, okay.
And it was where the lamp shop and the candy store filled both those spaces. And then the First National Stores was where the bookshop is now.
Did they all deliver?
No, the only one that delivered was Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, they were an outlet for S.S. Pierce, or Purse, as it was might have been called in those days. They carried a line of their products, which were a premium brand. Everything that Anderson had was premium. They had very, very fine meat, especially items. They were much more expensive, and of course, the delivery feature added to the expense. If that was not tacked on as extra, you just got that as a service. There were interesting characters, of course, down the main street. Right on the corner, which is now the harness shop, I think, is the Richardson's Drugstore, which when I was young was known by Charles Boyd. Then going down, there was the fruit store next to that, which was owned by two Greek brothers. Adam, his name was. And then Pete the barber was next, who cut my hair for 40 years, I guess. And then the Mary Curtis shop, which was started by Mary Curtis. Unusual then for a Concord woman to start a shop. But she did it. She was unmarried. She was the mother. She was the daughter of Mrs. Alfred Curtis, who lived up in Grand Style on Lowell Road, got to be my godmother. And Mary, or Maisie, as we always called her, was a character and a wonderful person, who did later marry, but never had any children. The Battleground Restaurant, of course, and then there was a tavern down at the end where the real estate office is, going towards the right tavern. All I can remember is the sign which said Rupert's on Tap, and Rupert's was a type of ale. And various town characters in various stages of sobriety or inebriety were hanging around there at different times. Right across, of course, there was Vanderhoof's was there then, as it is now, and where Winston's is, was the 5 and 10. That was built, I think, that brick building, very fine building. It was built, a very large store. At the end of school, after the second, third, fourth grade, those years, my mother, as a big treat, used to give us a $1 bill and let us loose at the 5 and 10, and we could come back with a whole bag full of goodies and stuff, little things made in China, Japan, so a dollar went pretty far. The bank was where it was now, and it's called the Concord National Bank. What else? I think the Mary Ann was there. I'm not sure if it was called up, but I think it was a bakery.
Oh, Sally Ann?
Sally Ann, I'm
sure. Yeah. When you mentioned that it was unusual for a woman to start a shop, I guess Polly Cusin later on started one.
Yes, there were some other ladies that did that, Mrs. Cusin, and she was helped in that with her husband, Bill, who was Fritz's father,
mm-hmm.
Who was also an architect. And he took that old building, I remember, and did it over, giving it its pleasing architectural face, what you see today with the bay windows and the little clerestory shortened windows up top. Another lady who did that was Mrs. Newell Garfield, Louise Garfield, who had the tweed shop on Lexington Road in her house. It's a gray house. John Mack and Maura Mack live in that house now.
It's on the corner?
No, it's, let's see, you go from the Concord Art Association, and I think it's right next to it.
I see.
Going
okay.
East.
Mm-hmm.
And probably couldn't get zoning to do that now, but she has a little tiny L right off the house, and she had a very distinctive but muted sign called the Tweed Shop. And she did very well there. Later came the Wool Shop, and a number of course that was operated by a number of coffee ladies. Going back to the neighborhood just for a minute, it seems to me maybe the passage of time hastens this, of course, and embellishes it. No doubt that's true, but it seems that my parents' coterie of friends were incredibly fascinating characters. And I think in many cases they were people with great talent and individuality. Down at the end of Barnes Hill Road and Lowell Road, in what was called the Pilgrim's House, with Mr. and Mrs. Andrew Pepper. And he was the chief restorative architect of Colonial Williamsburg. And when other architects had no business at all going into the 30s, he was flat out, because that's when Mr. Rockefeller decided to restore the whole small city. He was a man of many parts. To me, he was like Thomas Jefferson, the reincarnation of Thomas Jefferson. He was distinguished. He was aristocratic looking. He was beautifully dressed. He was cultured. He had great courtesy and manners. He played the violin. He skied in Switzerland. There wasn't anything that he didn't seem to be able to do, plus to design these magnificent buildings. One of which he did for his great friend, another neighbor, Henry Lachlan, who lived out the end of Monument Street and had bought most of Gardner Lawrence's beautiful farm in the 1930s. And Mr. Hepburn designed a recreation of the James River Georgian plantation house for Mr. Lachlan, which still stands, and in my opinion, unquestioned. The most magnificent house in Concord, which stands, and few people ever see it because it stands at the end of a half-mile-long driveway down the banks of the Concord River. But it's a beautiful Georgian palace with matching flankers on either wing, connected with the hyphenated structure. It's a very large house, a magnificent setting. Mr. Lockham was one of the heirs of the Jones and Lockham Steel Corporation. He came from Pittsburgh. And he came to work here for Houghton Mifflin, when he became president. And his most famous client was Winston Churchill. And he published all of Winston Churchill's books after World War II, The Gathering Storm, The Hinge of Fate, and The Closing of the Ring, The Triumph and Tragedy, etc. He was a frequent visitor to number 10 Downing Street when Mr. Churchill was Prime Minister, and also later on at his home in Chartwell down in Kent. There were many, many other famous people that he knew, some of whom I had met over the years. One of whom, he also owned a beautiful castle in County Cork in Ireland, where he used to visit with him. On one of those visits, Lord and Lady Moran was staying with him. His real name was Charles Wilson. And he had been Winston's physician during the war. I'll never forget some of the fascinating stories that he told us about Mr. Churchill for over 40 years. The Robs, of course, were very close neighbors and good friends. We've mentioned old Mrs. Robb. Her son, Russell Robb, who was the father of my friend, contemporary Russell Robb III, lived in what was the old farmhouse, now been fixed up into a private residence, where Rusty Robb lives to this day. I think in some of Emerson's journals that they talk about their Sunday walks, he and Thoreau, and they would sometimes repair to that farm, to the lawn, with the magnificent, I think it was an oak tree on the lawn. We used to sit down underneath that oak tree and spread out the top, take a little rest. But that's where the Robs and the Rob children, who were my age, lived during the war years. I remember we were playing there in December of 1941, shortly after the bombing on Pearl Harbor. And Mr. and Mrs. Rob had two Japanese butlers whose names were George and Eddie Kitzenbauer. We were very fond of them, and all of a sudden a couple of cars roared in, and these men got out, and it turned out to be FBI agents, and they tore up the back stairs of the house into the Kitzenbauer's apartment. I don't know what they were looking for, but they'd obviously been directed out to check out these Japanese nationals, I guess they were. I don't know if they were citizens or not. I don't know. I suppose they were taken away eventually. I don't remember. Like many of the Japanese, most of the Japanese people were interned in camps during the war. I mean, that was the last day I ever saw George and Eddie, to my chagrin, because we were very fond of them.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you want to talk about the your school experience?
Yes, we'll talk about the schools that I attended. The first school I went to was the Brooks School, which is still in operation, although certainly in a different location. Gladys Brooks started the school down on Lower Monument Street, almost on the corner of Lang Street. It was a private house. I don't know how long it was there, not for very long, and then it moved over to Wood Street. But I was at the Monument Street location. And from there, I moved on to Peter Bulkley School down on Stow Street, which is now senior citizen housing. Those were memorable and wonderful years. The school was operated according to a very strict regime. I can remember all of my teachers and their names. They were mostly single. I think they were all single women who may have even realized that if they were married, they would have to leave teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the custom.
That was.
Miss Fonts, Miss Sheehan, Miss Fallon, Miss Kane were my teachers for those first four grades. And my father did not want to send me to a private school at that time because he felt it was very important for me to know all the people from all walks of life in Concord. It was enormously helpful to me to know so many people, many of whom are friends to this day that I met in the Concord Public Schools. For the fifth grade, he suggested to move me over to the Penn School, which was quite a different experience. I think my happiest school years were at the Penn School, from grade 5 through 8, under the aegis and direction of Roger Fenn, who was a really gifted teacher and educator, a man who had very strong thoughts about how boys should be taught and guided. And if asked who the two most important figures are or were in my upbringing, I would have to say Roger Fenn and my father. He stood for absolutely unyielding integrity, but he wasn't a stern figure either. He was a figure of fun and had wonderful humor. He was a devotee of science. He loved the birds, the outdoors, he loved nature in all of its forms, and he radiated all those things. He knew all of the local neighbors, and hockey and skating, for instance, there were no rinks, and so we skated all on neighbors' ponds. My parents, we had our own pond, known as Brown's Pond, and there was the ice pond, which was across the street on Long Road. There was Puttrick's Pond, there was Punkatasset Pond, and there was Emerson's Pond. And sometimes, because I lived close to four of them, my job in the morning before I went to school would be to test the ice in those ponds and then tell Mr. Fenn which ones were good for skating, and that's where the hockey practice would be that afternoon. These are all private ponds, of course, nobody cared. I'm delighted to have the Penn School come over and use the ponds. When skiing season started, we would just tramp over the back side of the hill behind Mr. Finn's house on Carr Road on our skis and go up to Punkatasset, and we could ski there at Gordon Hutchins' beautiful Punkatasset Farm. And the less gifted or skilled skiers would ski on the lower slopes, which is to the right, the south side of Monument Street, below what is now John Venus's house, and that was called Little Punk. It was Big Punk and Little Punk. Again, all private property. Punkatasset Farm, owned by Gordon Hutchins, was a magnificent dairy operation. An operating farm, to be sure, but sort of a gentleman's farm, too. He had a farm manager who lived in a small cottage next to him. I used to work there, as a matter of fact. He had beautiful apple orchards, and in the fall, many of the neighbors' children would go to work for Mr. Hutchins for a period of a week or two, picking apples. I can remember at the end of the picking season going up to the big house, and it is a big house. He had a little office off in the hall, and went to the big roll-top desk, and he would sit there, add up your time, and he had cash there, and he'd give it to you. A very kindly man who I remember with great affection. We could swim down in his pond at Punkatasset. Usually when we'd go down, we could drive down an old dirt road down there. There was a big barn. And it was rare that anybody ever would be there at Punkatasset Pond. We usually had it all to ourselves. For recreation in those days, we really made our own. We could play tennis and golf over at the Concord Country Club. We'd always get there by riding our bikes. There were no locks on bikes. I don't remember anybody that had a lock. During the war, to conserve gasoline, my father bought a motor scooter. It went 100 miles a gallon. And he used to commute from Barnes Hill Road down to the Concord Railroad Station. And he would, when he got there, he would lean the bike up against the edge of the station, right by the track, get on the train, go to work, and when he came home, there would be the bike. Never crossed his mind that anybody would steal it.
Incredible today, right?
Yeah, and nobody blocked up bikes, you know. I remember when my oldest child parked his bike down the mill dam in the late 60s, and somebody stole it. I was aghast. I mean, I simply couldn't believe that anybody would steal somebody's bike. Now you see these huge chains and combination locks that everybody has to tie their bikes up to at all times.
By the way, what kind of work did your father do?
Dad was in the real estate business, real estate management, and his company later became the Sheraton Corporation of America when they branched into hotels. One of his partners was Robert L. Moore, who lived in the Shattuck Hill, and whose son is Robin Moore. In fact, Robin used to work, when he worked for the company, he worked for my dad. And I think if you talk to Robin, he'll have nothing but kind words to say about his association with my dad.
Robin Moore, the writer.
The writer, yeah, who wrote The Green Berets and many other books as well, who's living, as we speak, in the Shattuck Hill, still in his father's house, along with his brother Johnny. Mm-hmm. And their wives, too. There was a lot of hunting in Concord back in those days. The population was much smaller, of course, and it was a lot more open land. Mr. Hoare, Samuel Hoare, who lived over on Great Meadows Road, had painstakingly accumulated over many deeds over time what is now the Great Meadows. And he owned that personally, all the Great Meadows, and used it as a private shooting preserve. Seems odd today, but that's the way it was. And with his friends, of which my father was one, they used to have these wonderful Saturday morning shoots down there for very few geese in those days. And I think the geese were protected, but these were for black ducks, mallards, any kind of wildfowl of that nature. And also muskrat. There were lots and lots of muskrat over in the Great Meadows. And through Dad's friendship with Mr. Gore, we were allowed to go over there in the springtime. We'd paddle down the river from the Lowell Road Bridge, which was owned by Henry Kies, where Dad kept his canoe, and we'd go in there. We'd have a 22, and we'd portage the canoe over the bank into the Great Meadows and float around in there looking for muskrats and shoot them with a 22. And when we get them, we'd skin them, and Dad would take the pelts into Boston or some taxidermist or something, and he would pay us $2 a pelt for them. Dad did a lot of fox hunting, with not fox hunting as we know it today on the back of a horse, but going after foxes with, I guess they used shotguns in those days, I'm not sure. I have a wonderful picture of my father with Sam Hoare and Henry Greenough, who lived up in Carlisle, and Mace Foss, four of them shooting the foxes. She's holding two dead foxes by their tails on the road here in Monument Street. Also, pheasants were plentiful. I'm amazed to think that all the pheasants have now left Concord because they were everywhere. You hear them in the fall, a distinctive call. And we used to hunt them and woodcock as well. I guess the pheasants have been replaced by the coyotes and the wild turkeys. Certainly there were no wild turkeys at that time. During the war years, talking about making our own fun, the gang of kids in our neighborhood, we formed our own personal army modeled on the U.S. Army, of course, and we used to drill, close order drill, up and down Barnes Hill Road.
This was World War II.
World War II. Yeah. We would drill, hardly any traffic going by, and we would drill with brimsticks and homemade weapons that we made down in the barn or something like that. One of the great memories and moments of World War II had to do with German POWs. Fort Devens was the scene of a very large POW camp, mostly for German soldiers who had been captured in North Africa. They had served in Rommel's Africa Corps, and they were crack troops, no doubt. There were quite a few Italians, too, but mostly it was Africa Corps, and they used to hire these POWs out to local farms, and they came down to the McGrath Farm over in Barrett's Mill Road, which was originally, of course, Colonel Barrett's house at the time of the Revolution. But we would go over, drive over and park, and they were the, I remember them vividly, and they were harvesting potatoes just past the McGrath farmhouse, and our eyes would be big as saucers because it would be the military police with rifles and carbines at the ready, and they knew that they were loaded in case any of these fellows bolted. And they were different looking. They were definitely, there were many, most of them were blonde, and their haircuts were different. We stared at them in total fascination because we had been led to believe, you know, that the Germans were monsters and weren't careful to gobble you up, you know, like a wild dragon or something. They were obviously pretty happy to be where they were, and nobody was going to bolt or leave. They were so lucky to be away from the war.
That's right.
The other memory...
And of course, they were so young.
Yes, they were. Yeah. They were probably 18, 19, yeah. 20. There was an observation tower on the top of Neshottok Hill that was erected. Many volunteers, including Roger Finn, who would do their stint. I'm not sure whether it was manned 24 hours or not, but it was manned on a daily basis. And it was there until the war was over, which was a reminder, sort of a chilling reminder, that, you know, maybe German planes would come here. I'm sure it was a great compliment to the German Air Force, because they never got any closer than England, I'm sure. But they, the people that were up there in that tower, they had to learn what the silhouettes looked like of all the fallen planes, and arc planes as well, so that they could differentiate them. There was gas rationing during the war, and I still have in my, I still call it my father's desk, I inherited it, and in one of those drawers there were many leftover rationing cards. You needed these stamps in order to get things like butter, margarine, I think certain meat, sugar certainly, and of course all important gas. You didn't use these cards for gas. You were given a card which was had stickum on the back. You put it up inside your windshield of your car. There were A cards, B cards, and C cards. A cards, I remember, my mother had an A card, and that gave her 4 gallons a week. So you stayed pretty close to Concord on 4 gallons a week. I don't think that the gas mileage was very good in those cars in those days. My dad, who was involved in the war effort, he was the director of the Boston Blackout Committee, and he had to go on boats at night off to Boston Harbor and observe how effective the blackout, because people had to put black crepe over their windows to keep sky glow down so the submarines couldn't see shipping, American shipping, etched against any kind of a sky glow from the cities. And it was very effective. But he had a C card, which gave him something like 10 or 15 gallons a week, so he could drive back and forth to these nocturnal meetings that she would have in Boston. And some of these sort of scary trips, as they would go out in private yachts that had been commandeered by the Navy. And they would go out at night, and of course the place was crawling with German submarines, because there was a lot of sinkings at that time going on out there.
Today in Concord, the ability to live here is very restrictive, and that didn't seem to be the case for many years when you were living here. No matter what your job was, you could somehow find a place to live in Concord.
That's true, Renee. I guess it's been said that the New England form of town meeting is the purest form of democracy that's ever been devised. And if that's true, it's alive and well here in Concord. I'd like to take that a step further and say that life in Concord in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, as I remember, was just that. It seemed like a pure democracy. For there was room for people of all walks of life, all the disciplines, all economic strata. Housing was really not the bar to living in Concord that it is today. Sadly, that's really sad. But I didn't ever know any policeman who didn't live in Concord or any fireman. Everybody lived here. And there was a wonderful camaraderie. Maybe the passage of time is embellishing these thoughts, but it seemed to me that there was a terrific feeling of camaraderie between people at both ends of the economic spectrum. That this really was a sort of a classless feeling of pure democracy.
Well, I guess another aspect that I'd like to ask of you is, we're looking at out the window and a positively beautiful view. And if you could tell me a little bit, we're on Balls Hill Road, a little bit about this area, this property.
In a roundabout way, I'll get there. Henry Kies lived on Liberty Street, and his family's farm ran from Liberty Street all the way to Balls Hill Road, almost over to the ice pond at Bowl Road. He had a boathouse where he kept canoes and allowed my dad to keep his canoe there. He used to frequently go down. The rivers were a source of terrific recreation for Concordians in those days, because you didn't jump in your car and drive to New Hampshire or Maine like you did there in Vermont. And so we had a wooden ribbed old town canoe, and my first visit to this property sitting right now. Remember, we paddled down, my father and I, in the old town canoe, and put in way down at the end of the dam, at the end of the pond, and walked up here, it's about maybe a third of a mile, and sat at a picnic in this field. I thought it was the most beautiful place I've ever seen in my life. Anyway, I kept coming back over the years, and finally in 1970, nothing had happened to it, and I talked to the owner, who was Warren Jenny, and convinced him that it might be in everybody's benefit if he sold the land to me, which he did. And that's how we wound up here. So we've been here now for 33 years, although we didn't move in into our house until 1972. So that's been 31 years we've actually lived here. We are adjacent to what used to be the Benson farm. Sammy and Tobin Benson owned it, and before their father, Christian Benson. It had been, it's my understanding, about 30 acres that had been carved out from the Brewster Woods. William Brewster, who was a early naturalist and the founder of the Massachusetts Audubon Society, had come out here and bought October Farm on Monument Street, and over patiently over 20 years had assembled about 300 acres. I also understand that he owned land on the other side of the Concord River as well. He used it for walks. He was a great friend of what they call their annual day on the Concord River, which is chronicled, I think, in October Farm or Concord River, one of the two books that was written by William Brewster. Maybe he wrote others, but those are the two I know about. He was definitely an ornithologist and a naturalist, and he lived in Cambridge, but he would come out to Concord frequently, and he would stay in October Farm. He also built a series of camps down along the Concord River on the river trail opposite the Great Meadows. The only things that you can see that are left down there now are the foundations, but they're very prominent, including a canoe shed, and you see his initials scraped into the cement. It says WB 1912 or 13, I think, something like that. Interesting to see it.
Now, the Benson land recently was acquired by the town.
After many years, the Bensons, Coburn Benson, decided to sell his family's farm. And we were, of course, very nervous because the price of the land, of course, it skyrocketed, and it didn't make it easy for anybody to acquire it for conservation purposes. And the developer was looking at it very seriously. And we had seen the developer's plans. It was going to be used for construction of several enormous houses, cheek by jowl from where we now live. Look, at any rate, the town of Concord decided that this was priceless land for municipal wealth. After a a special town meeting which approved of it, the town purchased approximately half of the Benson property, and my neighbor Charlene Engelhard, who now owns the bulk of the Brewster Woods, purchased the other half and basically has conserved it for posterity. So we're very, very lucky that the only improvements that we're going to see over there, at least for now, is a municipal well and a pumping station. And also it will be available, the part that the town owns will be available for town access for walks and birding and things of that nature.
Yes, I believe there was a special town meeting in 2001 for that.
That's correct,
which
was very well attended, and the presentations were long and lengthy, as I remember. I certainly was present, and when it came to a vote, it was simply overwhelming in favor. I think there were two or three nays, and that's all. So it was an interesting barometer on the town's sentiments towards conservation and protection of the Brewster Woods. Charlene Engelhard, my partner, she has two houses over there, one for a friend and her own house, which fits in very naturally. But the great bulk of all that land is still open. We've been very, very fortunate and lucky out this end of town along Monument Street with the conservation efforts that have been pursued over the years, and gives it its rural and agricultural, still maintains the agricultural flavor of what it looks like. It's really, to me, so unchanged from what I remember as a child. And I got to know this part of town well because the Concord school bus would pick us up on Barnes Hill Road, and then it would run us out. We would have to go all the way to the Carlisle line out the end of Monument Street to pick up the Windalls. They lived on the Windall farm. And also, I can remember stopping at Balls Hill Road, where we are now, to pick up Coburn Benson. Coburn Benson actually was a classmate of mine. He sat in the desk at the desk immediately behind mine in first grade. That's how I first met him.
Well, I thank you very much.